use my axe! I'm hungry!
Welcome to the inaugural edition of Get to Work, Hurley. This is an endeavor that has actually been made possible by folks on Patreon. The monthly podcast is, of course, a milestone reward. Super exciting. So we have reached that level, and now you guys get to like listen to me rant about life, the universe, and everything. We're going to go ahead and get started. I promise that at some point, you know, we are going to have some special guests. I am interested in speaking to lots of fabulous people. But for now, I think this is just sort of my off-the-cuff ranting about some issues of the day and giving you my particular take. That's how we're going to end up getting started. For those who are unfamiliar with me, I am a Hugo Award-winning novelist. I'm also a full-time advertising copywriter. That means all the spam email you get, a bunch of websites that you browse through, and some of the direct mail that comes into your home is written by folks like me. Believe it or not, it pays way better than writing fiction. And there's benefits and a profit-sharing program. So I'll be doing that for a while. I write a ton online. I give folks my opinion on things. I also have a background in historical studies and actually revolutionary movements in the 1980s, in particular revolutionary movements in Southern Africa. That's what my master's thesis is on. I know all sorts of things about the past, and I'm, you know, both horrified and... horrified, I think, is still the word, to see the cyclical nature of history, which every writer tries to warn us against, especially those who have been through military conflicts. They say it's coming around again, it's coming around again, and we never listen. We never listen. So that is a little bit about me, and now we're just going to kind of launch right into some of the topics of the day. Okay, so first I want to talk a little bit about writing and entitlement. This is on my mind because I actually recently had a lunch with a couple of other pro writers. We were discussing the field and how there is sort of a disturbing thing that happens, especially as folks in the field who have published maybe one or two novels. They see sort of this there's a clear path, and it tends to happen to straight white men. That is, it tends to happen to them more often. The rest of us are not necessarily so entitled. But it's something that happens, and I see it also happening in the wider world, which is why I want to kind of bring it up. I think it's an interesting way to understand entitlement and how people approach life and the promises that we've all sort of been given, or not all of us, that mostly straight white guys have been given in our society. So this one was the idea being that, you know, you start out in the field and everybody's like, okay, you start out the same way. You know, you start submitting a bunch of short stories when you're in your late teens, or early mid 20s, start to get a few sales in your late 20s, early 30s. You publish your first book, you know, early 30s to mid 30s. And then you just keep publishing books, right? There's this assumption that you just kind of keep going up and up and up. And then eventually, you know, you make a ton of money. You go full-time writer at 40. By, you know, time you're 60, you're a grandmaster, right? That's the way it is. I laughed when I heard this because, of course, for me, I never expected that, right? That was something certainly that you fight for and that you hope for, but it wasn't something I felt like, oh, if I just do the work, it will magically happen. I know too much about all the other things that are going on in the world. I don't want to say keep me down, but I know what's working against me, and I know that a lot of this business and any kind of business is luck. Luck as far as who's in positions to buy your book, how the market is performing at a certain time. Luck in your personal life, your health, family, how things are going there. There's just so much that happens throughout someone's lifetime that's, you know, there's plenty of opportunity for those things not to happen. It's not something you're owed because you want it or because you're a straight white guy. Or because you did the work, right?
And again, even me talking about this, I find it so for, I find this idea of this entitlement so foreign, but it is something that has been encountered quite a bit with a lot of folks in the field, where there is a sense that they just feel entitled. And I think we saw this quite a bit, for those of you who are familiar with it, in the last few years with the Hugos and the Sad and Rabid Puppies, you know, this kind of group who decided that, you know, our stories aren't getting awards, so there must be some huge, massive conspiracy against us because the field had changed, and who, you know, the sorts of stories that people were interested in and people were buying and were not only different, but in fact, and here's the big one and no one wants to say it, but in fact, really fucking good writers are coming into the field right now. I don't want to say unprecedented, but it may be unprecedented. This is an unprecedented time in the history of science fiction and fantasy. And I think in almost any field, you see more and more that Nobel Prize winners are older and older. One of the reasons that is, as has been pointed out, is that there's simply more, there's more information out there. There's more stuff that you have to take in. There's more reading and learning and studying and fewer open, I don't want to say fewer open doors, but there's fewer, there more is known. Right? More is known. So you have to fight a lot harder to make significant impacts in the field than perhaps you did 40, 50, 60, 100 years ago. Each of us is building our careers on what has come before. Writing is not necessarily any different. And so what you see quite a bit is, and this is why we see such a backlash, I think, is the more that folks who are used to having sort of this default privilege are asked to compete fairly, and it's still not fair, right? But to compete more fairly, they start to realize that they can't just be mediocre. They can't just show up and win awards and get accolades and get a blowjob, you know, in the back of the bookstore anymore. This is going to be a filthy podcast, just so you all know. That's probably not going to happen for them anymore. It's a lot hard. It's a lot more difficult. Oh, it still does. It still does happen. Let's be real here. It's like so much of science fiction fantasy is like a high school theater where there's sort of a lot of incestuous drama and you're not really sure what you walked into. And you're like, holy crap, what just happened? I actually started dating outside of science fiction for that reason. Like, oh, you've dated who else with who? And yet, and they did. Oh. Theater. So it's a lot like that. One of the things then is that, you know, people are being asked to compete at a different level with people who are actually much better, and being forced to compete on an equal plane when you are used to having all sorts of privileges feels like it doesn't feel like equality. When you believe that equality is you getting ahead all the time and you getting all the privileges, when those privileges are gone, that doesn't feel like equality anymore. It feels like you're being oppressed, right? I understand that intellectually, but it doesn't make things better, right? It doesn't make it better. I found this idea of entitlement in the field, especially among certain subsets of writers, but it happens to all of us, right? It's just, it so happens to happen to, you know, some of us more than others, to be really fascinating and to actually make a lot more sense as far as when I would look at how people were behaving in the field, the things that they would say, the attacks that they would make on other writers, where I'm just like, this is not, you know, this is not the way to get ahead in your career. Well, for them, it is, because they're not used to consequences. They're not used to competing fairly. You know, again, when we see this quite a bit, you know, people get kicked out of conventions when they get kicked out, you know, for harassing people for 20 years. And then they just go to some other convention and go and harass other people. There's the famous also, you know, Marion Zimmer Bradley, who protected her husband, you know, for years and years, and was known to be abusive. And again, like, these were actually like division, like people actually argued in the same way that they're arguing now, where I'm like, no, really, these are like, he was convicted, you know, let alone if like there's multiple harassment reports and things like that. These went to trial and there was a conviction and there were still schisms in the field. You're a convicted pedophile. Why would we invite a convicted pedophile to come to our convention? Well, the reason is because there was an us and there was a them. And we see that quite a bit, unfortunately, in science fiction fantasy, but also in lots of other places. Again, I always go back to the high school theater comparison. It's, well, Joe can't be a bad person because I know Joe, even though all these other people say Joe is a horrible person and he's been terrible to everyone. Joe is on the stage with me every night and, you know, we get back each other up and it's the same thing. anytime that you have a close working relationship with someone, you don't want to believe that they're necessarily bad to other people, when in fact that happens all the time. So I think that this culture of entitlement was very interesting to me. You see it again in writing circles. You see it in the wider culture. Everything that happens in science fiction is simply a microcosm, right, of the wider world. And that's something I always try to remind people. Hey, it's not that science fiction is broken. It is. But it's just as broken as the rest of the world, right? So there's a hashtag trending tonight. You know, things that men say to women authors. It's usually the usual stuff, right? How can you write anything but romance? And then, of course, people pointing out, you know, why are women authors so offended when they are, you know, when men assume they write romance, right? And I don't know that it's necessarily offensive, you know, to any of us. It's just an interesting first assumption. This is how assumption most people make for me is that I'm a children's author, which if you've read my stuff is hilarious. Again, am I offended because, oh, children's author? No, like they're making a lot of fucking money. A lot of YA authors make a lot of fucking money. They're very good at what they do. They're writing some of the best stuff out there right now. You know, romance authors are some of the best, some of the most brilliant people in the business. When it comes to business, let alone writing, obviously they're all great writers, but they're also some of the most incredibly business-minded people that you will ever meet. In science fiction and fantasy, we are not at all business-minded the way that romance writers are. Again, so it goes back to why is there this assumption then that as a woman that you're writing children's fiction or romance? Certainly the person who asks you that question has loaded assumptions about what those things mean and that you appear to be someone who would only write in those veins. Whereas we may feel, yes, that's actually cool. That's fabulous. Those people are doing amazing work. It is a little funny, right? They're bringing these loaded assumptions, you know, about what that type of writing is. And then they're applying it to you because you're a woman. You know, no one asked Joe Abercrombie, oh, so you do you write for children then? And in fact, he has written YA, right? But no one's going to ask him that question. Someone go to Brent Weeks, you know, oh, so you write romance then? Like, it's just not going to happen. I always find these assumptions about what we do and do not write to be very interesting because, of course, we still run into plenty of readers, male readers, but also women. I want to point that out. I had a very awkward, very awkward conversation at a con one year. I actually thought she was trolling me, like from Reddit or something, where I had someone ask the panel, and Margaret Weiss was on this panel, and I think it was me and Margaret Weiss were the only two women, but she said, you know, why the audience member was like, why do women writers write such terrible female characters, such passive, helpless female characters? And I'm like, you can imagine. And I think I started ranting about like internalized misogyny, and I started going on a rant, and Mike Underwood, God bless him, was on the panel, and he said, well, you know, you probably just means you need to read more women authors. You just haven't read a lot, because sort of strange assumption to make. I don't know that, you know, why do so many male authors write about violence? Could also be a question. Why do so many male authors write who are professors write about having affairs with their female students? Why is that? I don't know. What can it be? And it's like the answer is, well, yes, some do. Some do, and some don't. And I don't, you know, read writers who write shitty books and shitty characters. But nobody says, why is it that men only write, you know, only write X or only write, you know, Y? And we just never ask those questions. Like, why would we bother to even ask? Because, of course, whatever men write is totally just general, normal person, people stuff, right? And women are always sort of the odd one out. Now, you know, I get asked a lot, like, how do you operate in that kind of world, right? And I come at that, you know, I'm white, and so I certainly still have that privilege. My parents were working class, you know, they both flipped burgers at the local Burgerville. And it's one of those things where you ask yourself, yeah, I have, you know, these amounts of privileges and I get that. At the same time, you know, for all of us, anyone who has any kind of one or two or intersecting privileges, it's like, it doesn't mean life is easy. You can be rich and your life doesn't feel easy. But how do you kind of keep going when basically the whole world is completely stacked against you? I mean, it's all stacked against, you know, it's like there's a very clear line of how your life should end up. Oh God, I almost died when I heard what the Girls finale was, if you've watched Girls. Anyway, Girls, the show by Lena Dunham, I would say the first season is probably one of the most brilliant pieces of television I've watched. It was really good. They kind of all go downhill after that. I don't know what happened after that, if the other people got involved more or less or something. And then, I just read what the finale was, and I'll try not to spoil it for you. But, you know, I was quite disappointed that she went where she went. It's almost like, it reminds me of that whole, you know, life gets you down. Life gets you down, and all of your dreams will come to dust, and everything will just be the same, and you can never achieve anything, and your dreams are all shit. And it's like, none of that is... It's like, are the odds against you? Yes. The odds are against everyone. As I had said before, right? Life can intervene. Your health can intervene. Your finances can intervene. All sorts of things happen. I could get fired from my day job tomorrow, and that would totally change how my life is going. There are tons of things that could impact it. But to me, you have to, you know, it's the cheesiest thing in the world, but it does. It comes down to hope, right? It comes down to believing in a better future. Is that all bullshit? Probably. There's a great study about depression and how people who have mild depression, and this is not like manic depression, but people who have mild depression do actually see the world in a way that is more true to life, that is more true to actual facts and actual probabilities and actual whatever than people who are very optimistic. But that doesn't give them much of an advantage. It doesn't help you get out of bed every day being mildly depressed. Seeing the world for what it really is super depressing. And I think that's one of the things that we need to understand, is that we have to concoct sometimes these stories that are hopeful and that are better futures and that make things possible. And yes, are there examples out there that live of people who did very well for themselves? Absolutely there are. Is it still the most likely outcome? No, probably not. But you have to live for that better story. You have to hold on to that better story. Because if you don't have that, why get out of bed, right? I completely get that. I'm certainly not a person who, I'm not hardwired for faith or anything like that. I grew up my grandmother was Catholic. And so I read tons of old school Catholic, bloody, brutal Bible stories, which are the best. They were the best ever. And I loved them. They were super fun. But it just never took, right? And I understand why it exists. We need a story. We need something bigger than ourselves in order to carry on. We are driven by something larger, and we have to believe in something larger, no matter what that is. So for me, my something larger may not be, faith-driven, but my something larger is, hey, I want to make the world a better place. I want to make good work that comes after me. I want to inspire people to do better. I want to, again, be that voice in the darkness, the voice for hope. I want those things. I believe that I have to believe in things. And I think we all need to find those things that we believe in, because those are what keep us going. It's not fun. Anyhow, so moving on to something a little more hard business oriented, one of the things that a lot of other writers and I talk about is managing multiple streams of income. This would be, okay, again, I've shared my numbers and stuff with you guys before. I sold my first series. We did pretty well the first time we sold God's War. We got $10,000 per book. So, and then they got canceled. So they just like gave me all $30,000, which was great. That got me out of debt and saved my life. Basically, I was living in a friend's spare bedroom and was living on expired insulin. I'm a type 1 diabetic, which is a chronic condition. Not curable. And lots of chronic conditions are in my family, lupus and type 2 as well. So it's one of those things where the next time we sold them was for, I think, $7,500 a book or $6,500 a book, something like that. But when you look at, so the first time it's great. Hey, I get all this money for doing nothing. The second time I started really actually getting an idea of what I think they were 6,500. I think they were 6,500 because I think we sold Mirror Empire for 7,500 and Empire Ascendant for 7,500. Yeah. And so you got to get, like, Mirror Empire, you know, was like two years worth of work plus all the work I had done on the world building and stuff, you know, when I was like in my late teens, early 20s. Massive amount of work for $7,500. So that's like $7,500 in a year because, you know, you get your advance. The way they portion it out, it's divided by three, basically, when you turn it, when you sign the contract, when you turn the book and the book comes out. You can get that redone, you know, for different things. For Legion, when I sold UK rights, we got it all up front because the book was done and we were making money by that point with the Mirror Empire and Empire Ascendant at that point. So they just gave it, and it wasn't a lot of money. It was like £3,000 or something. And then, of course, then the pound, the pound got pounded in the butt. So then we lost, yeah, like, so instead of like $4,000, it was bad. Yeah, we lost like $1,000 in that deal. But anyway, one of the things, you know, I talk about quite a bit is multiple income streams for this very reason, because most of us are not making a lot of money on our advances. We are not all John Scalzi. We are not Patrick Rothfuss. Most of us are not. That's the 1% of writers. You know, even a lot of writers I know who are doing really well for themselves are making, you know, $20,000 a book is considered a decent advance right now. That's considered like, hey, write two books a year and make a living. Hooray. When instead, $20,000 prior to 2008, when like the whole publishing industry crashed, like $20,000 was like, okay, that's an advance, that's a normal advance. Now a normal advance is like $5,000 to $10,000. It used to be $5,000 was like a go away advance, like you wouldn't even bother. Now it's like, well, if it's, you know, a smaller publisher and you're a new author and blah 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 blah, bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. And I'm like, you know what? If you don't have the confidence in my book that you think you can sell $5,000 for the book, don't buy my fucking book. I mean, I'm going to say that flat out at this point in my career. Why would you buy it? Why would you, if you don't have any confidence in it? And here's the thing. Somebody gets your book for cheap like that, right? Okay, great. Hey, you published a book. Whee. Okay. They're not going to invest in it. They only have $5,000 invested in your advance. So why should they spend any money on your marketing? Why should they spend any more money supporting you? They're literally throwing it out there like spaghetti. For $5,000 advances, they are throwing your shit out there like spaghetti to see what sticks. Whatever sticks that year that they put out, they will put money into that one. So great. But they're not going to help you. You're going to have to do it all yourself. So get ready. Not that it gets much better. When you get to the 20,000 range, which I'm finally in, but when you get to the 20,000 range, I did get a lot of support from Saga. Joe Monti at Saga Press is great, and he's done a very good job. Thank you, Joe. I'm sure Joe is listening to this. But you know, you're not going to get this massive world tour that they're going to pay for. That's $10,000 or $20,000 when they've paid you a $20,000 advance. You just won't. You're not going to get a ton of help. So you have to be ready for that. So this is why you need multiple income streams. And I talk with other writers about this a lot. This could be, most writers, you know, are not making a living as full-time writers. They are making money from freelancing work. That could be, again, doing content marketing, writing blog posts. A lot of people write blog posts for like finance sites and web copy, the stuff that I do. I know a ton of people do that. I made quite a good amount of money for a while writing educational reading passages, right? Like those reading tests that you had to do in school to reading comprehension. So someone has to write those passages. That was good. That was like a buck a word. So it's looking for opportunities like that. It's connecting with other writers to try and get those, because you're just not going to make money. It's a lot of money, especially when you're first starting out. Could you be somebody who takes 5 years off and has their spouse support you, and you know, you knock out a great book and it sells a million copies? Yeah, sure, that could happen. Also, a pig could shit on you tomorrow too. You get hit by a bus tomorrow. Hell, you get hit by a bus. That's a much greater probability you get hit by a bus. Lots of stuff could happen. We could all die in nuclear fire tomorrow. Really, maybe a better chance of that at this point too. So anything is possible. But what my job is, and why I what I'm aspiring to do, is to give myself the best possible leg up. Like, you want your books to have the best possible chance. You want your career to have the best possible chance. So you invest in it like any other investment. And that's what I do. That was one of the reasons I started the Patreon. which is, you know, patreon.com/Cameron Hurley, my name. And it's been a really great way to not only force me to do more work, which is really good for me as far as getting a short story every month, and then again I can resell them to various markets, but also a great way to connect with fans, and of course just a great way to make extra money and to pay for a lot of the trips that I do, a lot of the marketing stuff that I do. I do a lot of swag stuff like stickers, and I think for Starstar Legion we did a Lesbians in Space alternate book cover, which was really cool. People loved it. We also did posters, but that shit was not cheap. It was expensive, and it all came out of the Patreon. So all of that stuff, a lot of that stuff, just I recycle it and I put it back into the career. Now, am I doing that because, oh, I have to do this, or I may have to just blah, blah. No. I do it because I enjoy it. That is true. And that was something Tobias Buckell said early on in my career, great writer. He said, Cameron, don't do the stuff that you hate to do. Or do only the things that you enjoy doing and fuck the rest. So I don't do a lot of appearances, like bookstore appearances. I don't do readings. I hate readings. Despise readings so much. So you don't see a lot of that. Well, I go to conventions, be on panels. Yeah, I'll do that. But not like single by myself doing stuff like that. Because I don't have funny fun. Why should I do something if I'm not having fun? This is, like, I have a day job. I have a day job where I have to make words for money that are for other people that are not mine, that do not belong to me, that literally do not belong to me. Whereas with publishers, and people don't understand the difference, a publisher is not your employer. A publisher is someone who is licensing your content and distributing it for you. That's really what a publisher is. And I know we talk on it. Yes, they provide editing support and marketing support, and then people have great relationships with their editors. But I don't want people to forget your editor is, your publishing house is licensing your content. They are a packager and distributor, ultimately. Do they have some creative input? Absolutely, but it really depends per editor how much that really is. Like a lot of my God's War books just sort of went out, they got a good copy edit and kind of went out the door. So it really depends on your particular book. And, you know, I've had certainly had editors who are much more involved. At this point, though, you know, my agent is the one who edits the majority. You know, and a lot of the big, heavy lifting she does herself. So that's something, you know, I want to remind folks is you need to keep control over, you know, your intellectual property, over all the things that you do. And you need to maximize, like, how much you're getting out of them. Like, all the short stories I do for Patreon, I resell those. I actively work to resell those to other markets to make more money on them. And then I'm collecting them all, and we're going to try and sell a short story collection, right? Or two at this point. You know, you never just sit on it. I mean, you've created, you know, content. You've created content. You're a content creator. Congratulations. Which is why I always tell people, do things you really love. If you want to write dinosaur erotica and make $40,000 a year writing dinosaur erotica, you go. You do it. Do what you want to do. Again, especially because we could all die in nuclear fire. Like I said, have a good time. Enjoy yourself. All right? Okay, I think that's all I have to say about income streams right now. I'm sure I'll come back to this later. There's so many different ways. There's also things that I'm being asked to do now, which is like speaking engagements, which I will only do in very specific cases, which I need to be paid appropriately, and they have to be in places that I think are interesting to go. There's one in Chicago in June, and I don't think there's one in Canada. It hasn't been announced yet, but there's another one in Canada they'll be doing. And those can pay very well. They can be several thousand dollars and up. I mean, if you're just like, hey, I'm not doing it, I'm not leaving my house for less than $10,000, then just say $10,000. And either they say yes or no. And that's what a lot of, writers, I think what was the big brouhaha, I think Gaiman had charged like a $40,000 speaking fee for at a library and ended up giving it to charity because there was such a brouhaha. But that's the reason those are so expensive, because here's the thing, as a writer at a certain point in time, God, especially when you have a day job and stuff, your time is worthwhile because your time is finite. You only have so much time. And it's a resource management thing, right? If at a certain point when everybody wants your time becomes exponentially more valuable. So yeah, so there's all sorts of different ways. You know, at this point, I've had lots of people also ask, If they can buy paintings directly instead of through Patreon, because of course I paint along with Bob Ross as like a stress relief. And of course I did it because I'm like, oh good, this is something that I'm not gonna, it's not monetized, right? It's just something I'm doing for fun. And now I'm like, oh well, what am I gonna do with all these fucking paintings? So maybe there may be a shop for painting, because I don't know, we're gonna run out of room here pretty soon. So there's that as well. So always be hustling, or as I got a sticker today that says, hustle, darling. Always be hustling is basically the mantra for anyone who wants to be a professional writer. Okay, so I'm going to move on to very quickly ask a couple of, or answer a couple of little questions from Twitter. And of course, let's see. What do we start with? Oh, we're going to start with Diana Rowland. Not Rowland, she will tell you. And she will explain vociferously why it is not Rowland. It is Rowland. Diana Rowland wants to know, if nuclear war does happen, does that affect my deadlines? And what's the future of publishing in the wastelands? Well, Diana, you know, that is a really fucking good question. I think nuclear war counts as perhaps an act of God, which I'm sure is covered in your contract. Always read the fine print. Go over that with your agent, as I'm sure you know, Diana. And make sure that nuclear war is covered under the acts of God clause. And it may be, in fact, that, you know, I think they're allowed to either push it out a couple years or like it terminates your contract. It really depends on what your contract says. So always check. Okay, what's the future of publishing in the wastelands? Now, I really can't make that distinction. I can't make that call, just because your wastelands are going to be different than mine, Diana. For instance, I hear there's a lot of oil near you, so you will probably be in the Mad Max Furiosa wasteland, whereas there's a lot of rainwater near me. So we are probably going to be water sellers and water carriers. So it's going to be very different. So we will probably, you know, the future publishing really is probably going to be, we're going to be writing a lot of messages back and forth via carrier pigeon for people, doing a lot of storytelling. We're going to be retelling Star Wars over and over and over again, and no one's going to know any different in 30 years. So we're going to seem like the most inventive, awesome people ever, because we're going to know these really cool stories, and people are going to think we just made them all the fuck up. We're going to be rich, Diana. In the end of the week, we're going to have as much water and oil as we want. We may be covered in vermin and also dying of nuclear fire slowly, but we will have the most oil and the most water. That's my pronouncement. Next question. What is your favorite form of pie, and how does it help you write? I don't eat pie. I don't eat a lot of sweet things. Do I like to? Yes, but it's just not good for me. So I don't really... Don't eat pie. I eat a little cheese, and that helps me write, because I can eat cheese again now, as opposed to a while back when I couldn't because I got sick for like 3 months. I got some kind of stomach bug or something. Apparently this happens sometimes. And for 3 months, I was lactose intolerant. It was the worst 3 months ever, and it was just horrible. And I thought, yeah, that it was just bad, because there's things I can't eat. There's already lots of things that I'm not allowed to eat, or they're really bad for me and make me feel bad because of my illness. So to lose cheese was like, I can't even talk about it. It was so bad. So anyway, cheese is good, and we're gonna live forever on cheese. What gave you the idea for Enyo Enyo? I always love it when people ask about that story. So Enyo Enyo was actually, and this is from M. Rowley. So what gave me the idea for Enyo Enyo? Enyo Enyo was a story written for the Lowest Heaven anthology, which Jared Shuren came to me, an editor, and he said, hey, we're doing an anthology about the solar system. Will you please, do you want to get on board with this? I said, sure, sounds fun. Enyo Enyo came from, I chose Eris, as you had to choose a solar system, a body in the solar system as your like planet. And now I had already started writing what would become Enyo Enyo. There was just this idea of this ship traveling at the very edges of the universe, not even the galaxy, but like the universe, altering you know, like in this living ship, which again, if you've read Stars or Legion, is a similar thing to what I'm doing there. But in this sort of living ship that was actually altering or shifting or changing realities as it went, every time it took a snapshot of a reality, it actually subtly shifted it, and people could kind of get, I don't want to explain the story to you, but you just have to read it. But anyway, I really love this idea of messing with time, and as someone who's on this ship and doing this journey, how they're kind of experiencing all of these different timelines at once, and so time kind of flows and becomes very strange. I just love that. I love the idea of doing something in vignettes of how everything's connected, what happens, you know, to these bits of herself that she has bartered away, and how these how it sort of comes to bite her. It's one of those things where it's like when anyone says, where do your ideas come from? It's like, well, they come from lots of different places. And that was one of those stories where, yeah, I had tons of ideas that came from a lot of different places. And I just had the opportunity when Jared called up to go, oh, what if I just did this around Eris? And that sort of became like the anchor for the story. Suddenly all the things that I've been noodling around with, like I've been writing scenes and vignettes and things with it, but suddenly having Eris for some reason in there really made me able to, you know, solidify the story. All right, Matt Wallace, ever good with the questions, and only serious questions from Matt. Matt only brings his A game to his question game. He says, why are star cards better than other cards? I don't know, Matt. Why are star desks better than other desks? You tell me, my man. You tell me. Sherry Knowlton wants to know, should I buy a typewriter for when we lose the power grid? Yes. Just, yeah. Yeah. Nyx's D&D stats. Oh, you'll have to ask my husband that, Mike. That's from Mike. Mike, I don't know how to pronounce your last name. Doughton? Doughton? Doubt? Doubt on? But Mike, yes, you'll have to ask my husband that. He is actually working on, this is a good segue, he is actually working on a tabletop game and a role-playing game based on the God's War series. We are continuing to work on trying to get a Kickstarter together for that. Diversify income streams. But again, my husband's a master game master and board game geek, so he is working on that particular project. So Mike, hopefully I will have an answer for you about that by the year's end. Okay, and we have reached the end of our questions for this particular podcast. And I think that's all I have for today. Hopefully next month, again, this is going to drop every month about the middle of the month, right after I get all my Patreon rewards and things out to folks. Thank you so much to everyone who is part of Hurley's Heroes. They're on Patreon, and that's patreon.com/CameronHurley if you would like to sign up and throw in a buck, get tons of cool stories every month, and you also can choose from original paintings. I'm telling you, we have a lot of paintings. So if you enjoyed what you heard here, please share it with your friends far and wide, and I can't wait to talk to you all next month.